Thank you very much for coming, everybody. Several years ago, I was invited into a local junior school to give a school leavers talk to a class of 10-year-olds. Dragons, knights, and wizardry being all the rage at the time, I decided to read a couple of sections from Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, beginning with a few lines of the original poem. Asked what language they thought the poem was written in, one kid wasn't a million miles away when he suggested Scandinavian. I think some of the words sounded like the names of bookcases and futons his parents had bought from IKEA. Another student wondered if it was American, and a boy at the back asked, "Please, sir, is it gobbledygook?" There are innumerable reasons for translating the poetry of the past, including poetry written in earlier versions of our own languages. The most cited justification is that without translation, the poems become illegible and incomprehensible. But allied to that, if such poems are not mediated into contemporary registers, they become minority interests, the preserve of experts and specialists only, like the gobbledygook of computer coding or legalese. Translations of old and ancient texts hold open the possibility of wider readership by keeping them within the reach of the literate public. It's a democratizing activity. Whether the literate public have any interest in the poetry of previous eras is open to question, although as Heaney's translation of Beowulf, Hughes's versions of Ovid's Metamorphoses, and countless ongoing productions of plays from classical antiquity prove, there is an audience. The dilemmas facing any would-be translator of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight are apparent from the outset. The poem having no title other than the name it's acquired over several centuries, just as the shape by which we now recognize it is but a typeset representation of the poem's physical appearance in the one handwritten manuscript copy, just as Gawain on some lips is Garwain on the lips of others. And that's without getting into the poem's methodological and mechanical processes, beginning with its meter. Mary Borough, one of the manuscript's most dedicated interpreters, while willing to divide its stressed syllables into major chiefs and minor chiefs, nevertheless concludes that the prevailing and underlying rhythm of the poem creates an ongoing swing of four simple measures per line, into which all its lines are ultimately accommodated. It's a theory she imports into a translation of the poem, the opening line of which reads, "Since the siege and the assault were ceased at Troy." In an expectation of poetic measure by the reader, the first two syllables of that line are automatically subdued, throwing the subsequent stresses onto siege, salt, ceased, and Troy. In other words, a neat four-beat line, two beats either side of an implied caesura, with the alliterating syllables distributed across the first three of those beats, thus replicating, arguably, the poem's most typical construction. But the first line of the original actually reads, "Sithen the sagey and the assault wast cessed at Troia." By some counts, that's as many as 15 syllables, meaning 11 syllables must be unstressed if only four of them are to be accented. Borough contends that in the spoken language of the Gawain poet, the final E of a word was no longer pronounced, except perhaps at the end of a line, which might bring the number down to 13 or 14 when we point the syllabic Geiger counter at line one. But that's still three or four more than Borough's line in translation. The real problem, though, is in those first words, "sithen the," i.e. after the or since the. In poetry, as anyone who works in a lyric mode should know, it's unrealistic to expect that three syllables can go by at the beginning of a sentence without attracting a stress or causing the syntax to flatline. "Sithen the" absolutely insists on being pronounced as a stressed syllable followed by two unstressed syllables, meaning that line one has at least five beats in total. Furthermore, the first line of a lyric poem is always a standard bearer for what is to follow, announcing how the poem means to go on. And with a great deal of variety is how Sir Gawain will proceed. Some lines, like line three, the tulk that the trames of treason there rocht, adhering to Boroff's four-beat swing theory, but others heading for six or seven beats, a variation that Ted Hughes recognised and pondered over in his essay Myths, Meters, Rhythms. Following a retrospective paper chase through Hopkins, Coleridge and Wyatt, Hughes identified a strain of outsider poetry going right back to Gawain and before, a non-conformist approach that didn't correspond to the structures of rhetorical English writing or conform to the patterns of accentual verse imported from France and Italy. This was a tribally inflected poetry of sprung rhythms passed down from ancient and mythical traditions, Celtic and pagan, presumably. Traditions nearly lost once Chaucer's all-conquering court poetry had won the day and pretty much euthanized on the slab of the page by interfering and refining publishers such as Tottle. It suited the rebellious Hughes to associate himself with such literary dissidents as he saw them and to make claims on their behalf. And his reading of Gawain as a more unpredictable and irregular work, metrically speaking, is certainly borne out in his own translation of seven and a bit of the later sections of the poem, a project he was never to finish. Towards the poem's denouement, Gawain offers his neck to the Green Knight's axe for the third and final time. The blade slices open Gawain's skin, that the Shaena blood o'er his shoulder is shot to the aether. In Boroff, this becomes, "and a little blood lightly leapt to the earth." But Hughes renders it as, "then over his shoulders, his bright blood shot to the earth." In this instance, Boroff has been forced to sacrifice some of the detail in the line in order to honour the four-beat bar of her translation. We might feel that the Hughes version is delivered with more relish, and it's certainly more accurate, for including a description of where the blood travelled to in relation to Gawain's shoulders, and richer for incorporating the shining quality of the blood. In fairness to Boroff, she does mention the brightness of the blood in the next line, but then so does the Gawain poet, and so does Hughes, glossing Blenke, B-L-E-N-K-E, i.e. glare, as blink, something of a playful poetic liberty, and in keeping with the shocking appearance of the red blood on snowy ground, as if it shot back a look in Gawain's direction. In saying all this, I'm not endorsing one approach over the other, just illustrating the available metrical options and outlining their attendant dichotomies. But scansion is boring, as I've just proved. So enough of the timpani and onto the string section, by which I mean let's move away from the poem's percussive time signature and look briefly at the agonies associated with word choice, again focusing on the very beginning of the poem. The first page of the manuscript is displayed here alongside Tolkien and Gordon's 1925 transcription in the revised 1972 edition, edited by Norman Davis. I've stated elsewhere that the job of the translator is to create a plausible universe. For many, that plausibility is secured by the faithful translation of each original word, i.e., through correctly defining its meaning, then selecting its most accurate contemporary equivalent. And in translating Middle English, this means finding equivalences not just between languages, but also across eras. But a plausible universe doesn't always imply a breathable atmosphere. by which I mean that a pinpoint literal substitution is rarely a guarantee of poetic achievement. This is especially true where rhyme is concerned, and true, therefore, of the so-called bob and wheel sections in Sir Gawain, where the correct present-day definition is unlikely to bring with it the required acoustic value. In fact, the issue applies to Gawain as a whole, being an alliterative poem whose life force is wholly located in the repetition of similar sounding noises. Let's explore this issue through line 2. The Borg Britanned and Brent to Brondes and Askes. Literally, or as near as I can make it, the city destroyed and burnt to charred wood and ashes. In pursuit of her four stresses, and with loyalty to those alliterative B's, Boroff renders destroyed as breached and replaces Brondes with the archaic brands. A more recent translator of the poem, Bernard O'Donoghue, finds a succinct and contemporary solution in "And the city flattened to smoking rubble," preferring the more expressive flattened to the generalized destroyed, but choosing a more generalized rubble over the very particular ashes. Flattened is persuasive if we agree that Britannid contains a sense of something broken down, distributed, or divided, as per its other two uses later in the poem and its Old English derivation. As for those ashes, O'Donoghue omitted them only reluctantly, I imagine. Being the ghostly and insubstantial residue of material antecedents, ash is a naturally poetic word, its single whispered syllable subconsciously freighted with aspects of cremation, funeral rites, human remains, and atrocity. Unfortunately, it offers few alliterative options in this context. Even if under the rules of the original, any vowel can alliterate with any vowel, and also with the letter H. Rubble is certainly redolent of the raised walls and collapsed buildings associated with destroyed citadels, though if it pertains more to non-flammable masonry and stonework, then O'Donoghue preempts that notion with the word smoking, inferring combustible material within the debris, and also implying an enduring aftermath. Of other translators, of which there are hundreds to choose from, Brian Stone introduces a new noun element to supplement his alliterative purpose, making it the battlements that have broken down and become burnt. Keith Harrison's Troy is beaten down in order to team up acoustically with Brands, though he makes the burg a town, not a city. Probably true by today's demographic measures, but carrying a somewhat provincial air. And in W.R.J. Barron's prose translation, those persistent brands have become charred beams. Tolkien's own virtuoso translation, with its appetite for recreating historical and poetic tones, occasionally reads as older than the original. Declining what is offered in terms of ready-made alliteration, he gives line 2 as, "And the fortress fell in flame to firebrands and ashes." The repeated fricatives producing a sense of festering heat and fizzing embers, though at the expense, perhaps, of those plosive bees in the original, materially redolent of physical impact, invoking the battering and breakage of war. Oddly for a poet, W.S. Merwin settles for a somewhat perfunctory, "the city destroyed and burnt down to embers and ashes." If any type of translation is to be avoided, surely it's the kind that I assume is delivered through the headsets of those MEPs sitting in the Grand Chamber of the European Parliament, i.e. simultaneous and information-based, doing everything possible to avoid inference and innuendo. Insert Brexit joke here, I've written. Let's assume, though, that by the end of line two, perhaps after dozens of false starts with umpteen crumpled balls of paper in the wastebasket or following several hundred hits on the backspace key, the would-be translator has arrived at a style of delivery that feels appropriate to the task and points the way ahead. And then we come to this, presented on this slide with modernized spellings. Roughly paraphrased, lines 3 and the first half of line 4 refer to a tulk, a man or knight, associated with treasonable acts at the fall of Troy, who was subsequently tried for his treachery. The second half of line 4 is somewhat confusing. Is it the man, his actions, or even his trial that was the truest on earth? But the bigger problem comes in the transition to line 5 and presents the poem's first problem of interpretation, a sort of Beecher's Brook that must be successfully negotiated if rider and mount, in the form of ancient poem and latter-day translator, are to continue the course. With no real punctuation to distinguish between clauses, we're now introduced to Aeneas and his honourable kin, but with no grammatical certainty as to his involvement in the aforementioned treason. Perhaps the tulk was Antenor, acknowledged in some ancient sources as a duplicitous character from Troy, though it seems odd for the Gawain poet not to identify him in a stanza where others are explicitly named, including Langebaird and Brutus and the unheard of Tyrius. On the other hand, if the whole passage relates to Aeneas and Aeneas only, why has he been promoted from traitor and tulk in line 3 to a nobler and more glorious Athol 2 lines later? For alliterative reasons, perhaps, though I prefer to think the original author was better than that. And it might be the case that a tiny error on the part of a scribe or copyist has made a contradiction, or at least a conundrum, out of what was intended as a nuanced ambiguity, an ambiguity relating to Sir Gawain's divided character and his forthcoming dilemmas. At a time when myth and history had a tendency to intertwine, invoking Troy gives the poem a historical and a classical gravitas. But more importantly, it establishes a bloodline between Arthur and the ancient world. Gawain in this telling is Arthur's nephew, and as a metaphorical descendant of Aeneas, he shares his psychological DNA. If we skip quickly to the end of the poem, where Gawain berates himself for his treachery and untruth, he is effectively recalling the same complaints made against Aeneas at the top of the poem, like a man admitting to fears and weaknesses passed down the family line. And this in a poem whose circularity of argument is reinforced through circularity of syntax. In fact, if those flaws were inherent in one of our founding fathers, they might also be interpreted as national characteristics. And it's interesting to think of the poem as a reflection of Britain's somewhat schizophrenic status as a country from its very beginning right through to the present day. Insert Brexit joke here, I've written again. But staying with Gawain the person for now, I'm interested in the idea that his moral quandaries are introduced by virtue of his ancient elder Aeneas, and then explored through a series of challenges and tests. That being the case, one way of approaching the text is to identify those narrative points where Gawain is confronted with a dilemma, then to consider the young knight's response. It's an approach I arrived at after working on dramatized versions of the poem with actors, always keen to understand Gawain's motivation at every step of the journey. Crucially, as well as revealing aspects of his personality, such a methodology also credits Gawain with a certain amount of free will, rather than viewing him as a plaything, entirely at the mercy of higher or invisible powers. Seen in that light, he makes an interesting comparison with the narrator protagonist of Pearl, whose only real dilemma is whether or not to believe the incredulous words of his precious jewel as she instructs him in the theological consolations of loss, consolations he will inevitably accept. But apologies. These are public lectures, and there will be people in this room or listening to the later podcasts who aren't familiar with the poem. So a very quick whistle-stop tour, during which those of you in the know can check the value of sterling on your phones, unwrap a Worthy's original, etc., etc. And those of you in the dark who don't want to know the ending can switch to Spotify. It's Christmas at Camelot when a green knight on a green horse enters the hall and invites somebody to trade blows with him, the return blow being due in a year's time. Gawain decapitates the green knight, who then puts his head back on his shoulders and warns the young man not to break his vow. 12 months go by. Gawain sets off to look for the green knight at the green chapel. En route, he's offered shelter at a splendid castle and becomes embroiled in a game of dares. Bertilac, the master of the castle, will give him whatever he wins while out hunting every day, deer, wild boar, and fox, in exchange for whatever Gawain wins during his absence, which turns out to be a series of cheeky kisses from the lady of the house and a magical green belt or girdle with protective qualities. Wearing said girdle, Gawain then submits to the Green Knight, survives 3 attempted blows to his neck, learns that Bertilac and the Green Neck are one and the Green Knight are one and the same, and the whole escapade was the work of the mischievous Morgan le Fay. Gawain then returns to Camelot wearing the girdle as a sash or baldric as a mark of his shortcomings. Spoiler alert over, phones down, sweets back in your pocket. Narratively speaking, Gawain's first decision is to rise to the Green Knight's challenge, the gauntlet having been thrown at the feet of the Round Table in general and taken up by King Arthur himself, even to the point of preparing to swing the axe. Gawain's intervention comes in the form of a courteous request. And while pondering his motives, we might also recognize the skill with which the Gawain poet handles the episode, having introduced Gawain some 230 lines earlier, but by name only, and as one of the many guests at the banquet, seating him next to Queen Guinevere as a matter of both drama and status. Retrospectively then, we're invited to imagine Gawain's silent reaction to the Green Knight's appearance and his internal deliberation during the laying down of the challenge, and to subconsciously observe the scene from his perspective, even though the focus of the action lies elsewhere. When it comes, Gawain's offer to take Arthur's place in the game, his maiden speech, if you like, is a particularly handsome passage. The young knight seeking permission from king, queen, and court to volunteer his services and begging for forgiveness should his intrusion be improper. Among his reasons for stepping forward, he lists his admiration for his king, for whom such a challenge is an indignity and a breach of etiquette, and his lack of brawn and brain compared to other knights in the hall, meaning his death would be the least loss if I live not, as Tolkien neatly puts it. Ethically speaking, this line finds its echo in the parallel scene at the Green Chapel. As something of a puppet master in the poem, we might assume that the Green Knight is, to a certain extent, mandated with authorial intentions. So when he states that Gawain's one wrongdoing was that he loved his life, the charge seems pertinent to his behaviour from the outset. Seen in the context of that remark, Gawain's apparent selflessness at the beginning of the poem might also be deemed somewhat disingenuous, with the prospect of promotion partly fueling his motivation. A possibility hinted at in line 359, paraphrase, being the first to come forward, it should fall to me. The words of a young man with an eye for the main chance who recognizes a no-brainer when he sees it. Gawain's interpolation is also a rash one. Semantically speaking, the like-for-like blow could have been delivered with a glove or a napkin, but his martial instinct as a knight is to reach for the weapon. In a lesser poem, Gawain's virtues and purity would be all-encompassing, or his flaws would be arch and his failings telegraphed. But in this speech, made by a tremulous adolescent on the verge of manhood, we detect both honour and hubris, and find sympathy for a young man eager to do the right thing, yet vulnerable to the impulses of his ego. And it's in passages like this that I feel we're dealing with poetry of the highest order. Complex yet eminently readable, brilliantly structured, and with a subtlety that takes the poem beyond the utilitarian requirements of doctrinal and instructional medieval writing and into the realm of literature. Because although Gawain's stated obligation towards his God and his faith are many and fulsome within the poem, they often read as perfunctory and superficial in comparison with his stated priorities and his course of action. Likewise, the author's commitments and duties, which in the end feel to privilege the poetic over the devout. A number of months after my own translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight was published in the US, I was visited by a representative of a Hollywood studio interested in producing a full-length animated feature film of the whole poem. It was a slightly embarrassing encounter for all kinds of reasons, not least because they hadn't realised I wasn't the original author. Like Gawain, with his eyes on the prize, I didn't tell them. Neither did I tell them that it would make a really terrible film. They were very excited by the image of the Green Knight holding up his severed head in his own fist. I think at that point in the movie version, two red laser beams would have shot out of his eyes and seared holes in Camelot's heavy wooden doors. But the story just doesn't have the narrative arc Hollywood expects us to expect of its products. Much of the persuasive power of the poem resides in its line-by-line detailing and its changes of pace. For example, in the painstaking depiction of the armoring of Sir Gawain, preceded by the accelerated description of the turning of the seasons, essential if we're to accept that a full year has gone by since the Green Knight gate-crashed the Christmas party. Gone by it has, though, at which point Gawain does not need reminding of his promise to participate in a return fixture with his tormentor. We aren't told if Gawain ever considered not honouring his vow, even if those gossipy onlookers at the castle who watch him ride out conclude that promotion to the rank of Duke would have absolved him of his duty. This happened a lot when I worked for the probation service, with colleagues who floundered at ground level being elevated to managerial positions, a process known as being kicked upstairs. But for all his choir boy piety and finishing school precociousness, Gawain exhibits a soulful credibility that won't allow such a convenient dereliction of duty. Why he so readily saddles up and rides out to keep his appointment with the blade, he doesn't especially articulate, but two points come to mind, both of them illustrating the minor or complementary role that religion plays in his decision-making, in my opinion. At line 564, it's a generalized destiny, either painful or pleasant, that Gawain resigns himself to, a what will be outcome, but not necessarily of God's design. And at line 465, before exiting the hall, the Green Knight's final taunt is, "Therefore come or be obliged to be called a coward," or words to that effect, or faint-hearted, as Tolkien puts it. Like treachery and untruth, Cowardice is one of the accusations which Gawain eventually levels against himself following his perceived failure. So we might be justified in thinking that he tears himself away from the comforts and company of Camelot with the Green Knight's words still ringing in his ears, literally, probably, in the never-made film version with full echo and reverb. And although cowardice might be a crime against the chivalric code and an offence in the eyes of fellow knights, it is no sin. Once again, Gawain's more pressing obligations feel to be psychologically or socially determined. So even if he sports the endless knot on the exterior of his shield and the image of the Virgin Mary on the inside, beyond the religious furnishings, we detect a beating heart and a thinking mind. In referring to destiny, Gawain is presumably anticipating that moment in the future when the Green Knight's axe and his own neck finally come together. And fate of a kind plays a part at other dramatic thresholds or turning points in the text, occasions when it feels as if Gawain's decisions have in part been made for him, though by authorial rather than divine intervention. Early in Fit 2, just seconds after beseeching the Lord and Mary to find him a place of shelter and somewhere to hear Mass, the castle of Haute Desert appears before him in one of those acts of poetic pointing the Gawain poet excels at, zooming in on some fine detail or offering a changed visual perspective through a particular point of view. The castle is pared out of papur puli it seemed, like a paper model of the type used to decorate cakes or pies at a medieval banquet, implying both high-end accommodation and lavish substance to boot. We're talking relay and chateau here, not travel lodge with a little chef across the car park. Yet despite appearing heaven-sent, i.e. in response to Gawain's prayer, we would do well to remember that this is Bertilac's castle and that Bertilac is the Green Knight. In other words, rather than through the workings of an interventionist god or via our protagonist's skills as a navigator, the means by which Gawain finds the castle, or the castle finds him, is magic. True, the decision to approach the castle is his, but in reality, what options does he have? Exhausted, starving, freezing cold, and having endured an arduous journey across a British countryside beset by dragons, giants, and wolves, plus an alliterative combination of bulls, bears, and wild boars, plus the sinister Wadwo's eyeballing him from the crags, this shimmering stronghold, with its exquisite turrets and gleaming chimneys, is a gift horse not to be looked in the mouth. What kind of god responds to a plea for sanctuary by delivering his subject into the arms of his mischief-making nemesis? Of the other minor decisions Gawain makes in the poem, for example, whether to agree to Bertilac's wager and whether to heed the guide's doom-laden warnings on his way to the Green Chapel, again, either by social duty or through personal conviction, Gawain isn't really presented with a choice. As to his decision to reject the amorous advances of the lady of the house and to parry and deflect her sexually charged conversation, this feels as much a literary imperative as a moral one. Adultery and cuckolding certainly weren't out of the question in a medieval story. Just ask Sir Lancelot. But in this text, such an indiscretion would have completely overbalanced the plot. A plot designed to give Gawain the opportunity of acknowledging his shortcomings and yet be recognized by the Round Table and the reader, even by the Green Knight to some extent, as virtuous, heroic, and most importantly, likable. Delivering Gawain into the medieval equivalent of a swingers party, where spurs rather than car keys are thrown into the fruit bowl, would have also robbed the poem of its choreographed subtext, things the author has worked hard to achieve. For example, through those visceral and lustful hunting scenes with their disrobed flesh and penetrative culminations, telling us all we need to know of the fantasies and desires running riot beneath Gawain's polite conversation. And there must be an equivalence of risk between the two beheading scenes which bookend the poem, an equivalence overbalanced if aspects of sexual infidelity are introduced. We should also assume that even if Gawain had given in to his feelings, at some stage the lady of the castle would have withdrawn her invitation. I say this because, as Bertilac tells us, I send her to assay thee. I sent her to test you, a test which presumably didn't need to go all the way. Bertilac's setting of a honey trap would have been utterly reprehensible had he required his wife to literally embed herself. And if Gawain is to be tried for his behaviour, the internal logic of the poem insists he cannot be tried by a full-blown hypocrite. The fact that Gawain accepts something from the lady, which has sexual connotations, a belt from around her waist, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, is more than enough in the context. Of the remaining dilemmas, they can be thought of as the most significant by far, simply because Gawain gets them wrong. The belt I've just mentioned, and is offered after two attempts by the lady to give Gawain a gold ring. On both occasions, he rejects this symbol of betrothal with its implications of unfaithfulness and bigamy. But another ring of sorts, this one an intimate piece of the lady's attire, circumscribing her waist, now comes his way. Undoubtedly, Gawain has been played, softened up by the offers of the gold ring, after which the belt is thrust in his direction as something of a last-ditch compromise. In fact, the lady has even removed it from around her body as she makes the proposal. Again, Gawain refuses, but on hearing of the belt's magical, life-protecting qualities, his resistance crumbles. The poet, on this occasion, granting us access to the turning cogs in his protagonist's mind. A rough translation being, then the knight considered it, and it entered his thoughts. It was a godsend for the jeopardy which he was allotted when he reached the chapel to meet his doom. Gawain takes the belt, and in doing so, commits the twin crimes of cowardice and covetousness, as he later defines them. In terms of cowardice, not accepting enchanted belts was never one of the agreed rules of the game. If the Green Knight has superpowers, he's green, has a green horse, can self-medicate after decapitation, why can't Gawain help himself to a little magic of his own? But the virtuous young knight has his own standards to uphold and a private moral code by which he must abide. And against that self-imposed ethical framework, the use of an enchanted girdle as a defense against destiny is an illicit and gutless one. The covetousness comes from loving his life, the opposite of charity and an unseemly character trait in chivalric circles, and also from desiring the woman, i.e. coveting his neighbor's wife, though the idea that Gawain might have broken one of the Ten Commandments is never explicitly stated. In his final summary of events, the Green Knight finds Gawain not guilty of wooing, as he puts it, something of a lesser charge, but Gawain appears to judge himself more harshly. It's understandable. If you're wearing somebody else's belt or girdle, given to you in a bedroom by someone whose partner is out at work, at some level, let's face it, you're coveting. A girdle, by the way, that during its symbolic progression from belt to baldric is referred to henceforth as a love token or lovelace, once by the narrator and once by Gawain himself in an embarrassed speech about the faults and frailty of the flesh perverse, as Borov puts it. Gawain's second crime, and the highest tariff of his misdemeanors, according to the Green Knight, is in failing to hand over the belt as per the agreed terms. Just to recap, what Gawain wins in the house during the day, he must give to Bertilac in exchange for Bertilac's winnings in the field. When Gawain's winnings turn out to be one kiss, then two kisses, then three kisses, the psychosexual tension within the poem rises to another level. A lie is being told. A man is kissing a man. One of those men is contemplating wearing an item of clothing from a woman's wardrobe, and that woman is the other man's wife. All those elements combine to make this section of the text more transgressive by far than any of the supernatural episodes, one that subverts social conventions and undermines decorous behaviour, while at the same time pushing the poem towards the pantomimic and the absurd. Though personally, I feel the author has missed a trick, dramatically speaking. When Bertilac arrives home from the final hunt after slaying the fox, it seems he goes directly to the hall and meets Gawain by the fire. In other words, he hasn't spoken to his wife, so won't have been told that Gawain accepted the belt. As a shapeshifter and an illusionist, I suppose it could be argued that Bertilac's magical powers also run to paranormal omniscience. If you can turn a horse green and speak with a severed head, I guess you can be everywhere at all times. And the plot doesn't hinge on Bertilac knowing about the belt at that very moment. Though in light of such an understanding, Gawain's flustered demeanour and hastily delivered kisses would have escalated the theatrical and comedic possibilities of the exchange. The bigger point, however, is still made. Gawain tells a lie for which there will be consequences. And Gawain's third crime is to flinch from the blade. In terms of the storyline, by this point, our young hero has located the Green Chapel in what some commentators believe to be Lud's Church, an eerie gorge or cleft in the Staffordshire Peak District with primitive and clandestine associations. Gawain offers his neck and the Green Knight hoists the axe. The critic J.A. Burrough has said of Gawain that he analyzes his single fault into three moral constituents: cowardice, covetousness, and untruth. And if we agree with those subdivisions of his overall failure, we might find evidence of all three in this one action. Cowardice for not keeping still, covetousness in loving his life too much, and untruth in terms of not being faithful to knightly virtues, which must include among them bravery. In flinching, Gawain is also denying the Green Knight his right of reply, so he's not being true to his word. And I say flinch, though the Gawain poet uses the word shranker, S-C-H-R-A-N-K-E, which in Middle English, as in Latter-day English, includes wince among its definitions, hardly becoming for a member of the Round Table, as well as the more literal to become smaller, an insult a sensitive, fledgling adventurer hoping to prove his manliness and stature would have been skewered by. That said, it's a reaction that once and for all presents Gawain as a living being, subject to the laws of biology rather than the requirements of religious homily. In another of those examples of pointing, at the moment of reckoning, Gawain glances sideways or from the corner of his eye sees the falling axe, and his response is an entirely involuntary one, like blushing or blinking. In a split second, animal reflex and the survival instinct override whatever philosophies and ideologies have been imposed on the mind. The stages of the Catholic confessional and a tableau of Christ's crucifixion might be identified in the psychic structuring of this beheading triptych, but only as sacrificial images to a more secular message, props and costumes and scenery from which Gawain emerges mortal and earthly. In such a numerically configured poem, it's both convenient and satisfying to identify those three key moments when Gawain falters, the rule of three being deployed throughout as a literary device, and three being a magic number, as hip-hop outfit De La Soul pointed out in their 1990 single, The Magic Number. With the kind of direct user-generated logic that distinguishes it from published works of reference, Wikipedia reports, in the song, the trio state that the number three is a magic number. So there we have it. Unfortunately, by which I mean fortunately, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight isn't so easily summarized or explained. So I'd point to a fourth occasion when the protagonist's decision-making has a critical bearing on the storyline. Returning to the wooing scenes, it's worth remembering that on accepting the belt, Gawain is made to promise not to breathe a word of it to the lady's husband. Problematic, since his immediate loyalties would seem to lie with his host rather than with the woman who entered his bedchamber without invitation. On the other hand, lying to Bertilac only infringes the rules of a game, whereas admitting to the belt might constitute a violation of trust suggestive of adultery. Throw in the issue of the belt's special properties and the scales tip in the direction of concealment. I don't think the importance of this incident, both to the plot and the poem's moral ramifications, can be overstated. And it might be for that reason that the Gawain poet is at pains to spell out clearly and over several lines what has taken place. In the 2007 prose edition of the Poems of the Pearl manuscript, Malcolm Andrew and Ronald Waldron translate the passage as follows. Then he gave in to her insistence and allowed her to speak, and she pressed the belt on him and offered it to him earnestly. And he consented and gave in of his own free will. And she implored him, for her sake, never to reveal it, but faithfully to conceal it from her lord. The knight agrees that no one should ever know of it, indeed, but they too on any account. Checkmate. It seals Gawain's fate because honesty of one kind involves deceit of another, condemning him to the kind of untruth which he so passionately disapproves of. Incidentally, free will here is a rendering of good willer, not every translator's verdict. In fact, Murray Boroff, Brian Stone, and Keith Harrison see the glad giving of the belt and the goodwill involved as belonging to the lady. Of those who attribute the expression to Gawain, O'Donoghue reports that he gave in with good grace, Tolkien that he agreed to take it, Merwin that he accepted it, Anderson that he consented, Baron that he consented and surrendered very willingly, and James Whinney that he consented and gave way with good grace. Whichever and however, in receiving the belt, Gawain has entered an illicit pact, the momentum of which insists he must maintain the secret. Such compliance would appear to confirm Gawain as the architect of his own downfall, especially if we suspect that in keeping the conspiracy silent, he hopes to get away with it. It should be remembered, however, that in seeing a chance to bring this excruciating social predicament to an end, while at the same time improving his chances of survival in the longer term, Gawain has walked into a cruel and cleverly constructed trap. Like his recoiling from the blade, the response is intuitive to the point of being automatic, a choice that he will interpret as failure, but one that draws sympathy from a reader because it casts him in the role of victim. Attracting less sympathy, especially from a modern audience, is Gawain's diatribe against women, a tirade prompted by Bertilak's disclosure that he directed his wife to Gawain's chamber to test him. But no marvel it is if mad be a fool, and by the wiles of women to woe be brought. For even so Adam by one on earth was beguiled, and Solomon by several. And to Samson, moreover, his doom by Delilah was dealt, and David was after blinded by Bathsheba, and he bitterly suffered, And all of them were betrayed by women that they knew. Though a fool I now am made, some excuse I think my due. Gawain's illogical and uncomfortable conclusion might be explained away by virtue of medieval sensibilities, but a contradiction in the poem's narrative chronology seems to me to shed more light on this sudden and aberrant outburst. By which I mean that Gawain readies himself for his invective by identifying two female persecutors, where at this point in the story, the only woman involved in the conspiracy, as far as he knows, is Bertilak's wife. Not only that, Bertilak's wife took part at the bidding of her husband. I send her to assay thee. In a game of his making, I wrought it mycelf, making Bertilak the real culprit. And although it's true that Bertilak himself was acting on orders from Morgan le Fay, Gawain doesn't know this at the time of his tantrum. Such an uncharacteristic continuity error by the poet, followed by an uncharacteristic rant by Gawain, leads me to believe that a certain amount of authorial control has been lost over these passages. Like many writers in an age when plagiarism was as much a badge of learning than a crime, the Gawain poet appropriated storylines and pirated material from diverse sources. Murray Boroff identifies two earlier Gawain poems in Old French, The Mule Without a Bridle and The Knight of the Sword, poems which include elements of the beheading and temptation scenes, respectively. And several Arthurian stories begin with the interruption of a meeting or celebration by a stranger bearing strange tidings, an enduring staple of literary and dramatic structure, J.B. Priestley's and Inspector Calls, for example. What distinguishes the Gawain poet from more jobbing writers is the virtuosic reshaping of such material into a unique stylistic enterprise. Whereas what distinguishes Gawain's misogynistic outburst from the rest of the poem is its cut-and-paste complacency, the feeling that an entire system-built section has been airlifted from one text and parachuted into another. I can offer no evidence for that theory. I'm not qualified in the field of literary crime scene investigation. It's simply a speculative observation made by a poet looking at a poem, recognizing the craft and craftiness of the greater part of its composition compared with the crude mechanical excursus that takes place four stanzas from the finish line. Or maybe the poet was just having a bad day. Again, something I can't prove but can certainly empathize with. The hero of this epic is an anti-hero. By preemptively attacking a monster, he brings on himself a disaster that can only be overcome by an agonizing journey, a quest that results in wisdom by proving its own futility. That's actually Stephen Mitchell in the introduction to his free-handed version of Gilgamesh. And like Gilgamesh, Gawain is a hero for all times, by which I mean he's hardly a hero at all. From Batman to the Incredible Hulk to Deadpool, from Wonder Woman to Daenerys Targaryen, the successful contemporary superheroes of comic strip, graphic novel, cinema blockbuster, and box set are determinedly imperfect individuals who whose feats of physical bravery and wrong writing are always eclipsed or undermined by personal struggles and inner conflicts. And today's heroes have inherited their defects and shortcomings from the heroes of myth and legend. Euripides' Heracles, returning home triumphant from his miraculous labours, only to slay his wife and children. Damaged and divisive Odysseus, wily and guileful in his pursuit of home, boastful and vengeful in triumph, faithful to the point of unfaithfulness, a lover of his own life. In creating the conditions for a flawed hero like Gawain to flourish through failure, the Gawain poet had to create for him an adversary of similar ambiguity, a figure both human and monstrous, being green and a half-giant, but one who is slender, handsome, and in his communication with Arthur, quite literally a speaker of the king's English. As further evidence of that ambiguity, he holds in one hand a fearsome weapon, but in the other a branch or bunch or cluster of holly, an evergreen token of life and peace. Colonel, you write "born to kill" on your helmet and you wear a peace button. What's that supposed to be, some kind of sick joke? Private Joker, I think I was trying to suggest something about the duality of man, sir. Colonel, the what? Private Joker, the duality of man, the Jungian thing, sir. Pause. Colonel, whose side are you on, son? Private Joker, our side, sir. Like his contradictory opponent, Gawain is similarly divided and therefore similarly on our side. Through his decisions and choices, he learns the hard way that to err is human, to be born is to be a hypocrite, and to recognize and admit one's inadequacies is to come as close to triumph as possible. Thank you very much.